Over 300 years ago in County Antrim, an 18-year-old girl called Mary Dunbar accused eight local women of being witches. It led in turn to Ireland's only recorded mass witchcraft trial. A community swept up in hysteria and panic watched as the women were condemned to prison and pilloried. A new novel chronicling this incident seeks to find out or show why these accusations were made and why nobody spoke up. Its author is with me in studio, Martina Devlin. Good morning to you. The book is called The House Where It Happened. Tell me, first of all, let's begin, I suppose, with the facts. What do you know, or what have you been able to establish about Mary Dunbar?
That she was dangerous. Well, she was of Scots descent, Ulster Scots in Antrim. She was 18. She was described as very attractive. She had an open, pleasing countenance, according to contemporaneous accounts. She was said to be intelligent. She was from quite a well-off background, so she was of a higher social class than the women at whom she pointed the finger.
She landed up in a place called Island McGee.
Yes, that's an interesting little place. It's tucked away in a corner near to Carrickfergus, and it's a peninsula quite out of the way, very much settled by Scots Presbyterians. And Mary Dunbar arrived there in 1711 to stay with relatives, and almost immediately a change came over her. She started claiming that she was bewitched, that she was being persecuted by witches, and she had convulsions during which three strong men could barely hold this slim little girl down. She regurgitated pins and waistcoat buttons. Her body bent backwards like a bow, with her stomach up in the air. She had imaginary conversations with the so-called witches, in which she quoted the Bible at them. It seemed to have been extraordinary, and the neighbours came from far and wide to watch this and to marvel.
So this is all well documented.
It's well documented. I was able to read about it in depositions which were lodged by eyewitnesses to the court. Now, of course, a lot of our documentation went up in the forecourts.
Flames.
Yes, went up that way. But there are depositions, all the witnesses who spoke at the trial lodged depositions with the court, and you're able to read these, including Mary Dunbar's. The one set of voices you hear very little of, you only hear in a secondary way, are the eight women who were accused.
Who were these women and what were they accused of?
Well, they were all local. They were from around the Island McGee or Carrickfergus area, and they were accused of witchcraft under a 16th century witchcraft act in Ireland. They were older. Often they were in some way deformed, lame, clawhand, pockmarked. One had fallen in the fire at some previous stage and had burns on her face. They were all Scots Presbyterian women again, and all of them denied the charges. Not a single one of them said, yes, I've been communing with the devil.
What were they accused? What were they said to have done?
To have bewitched Mary and to be Mary Dunbar and to be tormenting her, to making her regurgitate the pins and buttons, and she claimed that they were threatening to come at her with a big knife and cut her breasts off and things like that.
And how there's mention of they were kind of ghostly appearances or something,
yes,
to her. Tell me about that.
Spectral evidence. When you read the account of the trial, and we have a very good account of it because the Vicar of Belfast, the Reverend William Tisdall, who knew Dean Swift quite well, he was an executor of his will, he, among with many clergymen, was fascinated by this trial. It must have caused a sensation because there was witch fever in the air. It was the only mass witchcraft trial in Ireland, and people came for some entertainment, fundamentally. The Vicar of Belfast was there, and he wrote it up, a scholarly gentleman. He wrote it up, and we know what was said during the trial. We know how the witnesses behaved. We know that Mary Dunbar, for example, claimed that she couldn't give evidence, that the witches were stopping her speaking. She made signs and fainted away when she tried to go to the witness box. We also know that not one of the eight women had a lawyer, that there was no medical evidence taken as to why she was having these fits, and they accepted the spectral evidence you referred to, which, by the lights of which, Sean, you and I would be done for witchcraft. It means that even if you have an alibi, it's accepted that if you're a witch, you can send your shape to do your tormenting and spite in your name. So you can be anywhere else.
But clearly, if she was, if there were witnesses to the, you know,
convulsions.
The convulsions and the shape into which her body was contorted, in that bow shape that you referred to earlier, and if she was coughing up pins and horsehair and the like of it, something had to explain it.
Of course. I mean, that's where the novel takes over. That's where you have the historical documentation, which really only runs to a few pages. And at that stage, you look at it and say, well, do I write a factual book? And there have been factual books written about it. Or do I try and get inside the head of this girl and say, was she mad? Was she bad? Or was she worked on by something else? And so I married something else that happened in Island Magee, which was, again, is documented. In 1641, there was a massacre of the Magees of Island Magee by Scottish soldiers. There was a rising at that time. The Irish, the native Irish, had risen up and massacred the planters, and this was a reprisal. And the island, they turned up in Island Magee, and most of the Magees were wiped out. And this very famous case, which is disputed, but Cromwell took an interest in it subsequently and inquired into it, of some 30 Island Magee women and children being herded together by soldiers at sword point and being forced over the cliffs in Island Magee, the goblins they're called. I went up and looked at them, and you certainly wouldn't be going for a dip in them, the sharp rocks underneath. And I decided that, and also the house where Mary Dunbar stayed was said to be haunted. So I put all this together and made a ghost story out of it in the long tradition.
You were able to just use artistic license to take these two separate events and incidents, so to speak.
And marry them.
And also you used a very interesting device as your narrator. You have a servant in the house.
Yes, that's right. I chose to tell the story through a servant girl, Ellen, because servants can move easily between the posh folk and the ordinary folk, and they can be in a room listening to what the ministers are saying and what the master and the mistress are saying. But also she's your classic outsider because she doesn't quite belong to the family, and yet she's intimate with them. And she's observing what's going on and trying to make sense of it. I became very fond of Ellen, actually. So it's just a way of telling a story, really.
And the women, and this is we're moving back to, I suppose, fact as opposed to fiction here, Martina. They were lucky they were charged under, was it Irish as opposed to Scottish law?
Yes, they were very fortunate because it was a first offence. It was a felony. And a first offence, you got a year in prison, which was no junket, let me tell you, and you got four turns in the pillory. But if you had been charged under the Scottish Witchcraft Act, you would have been executed. So, I mean, what's interesting about doing something like this is the research, really, but at some stage you park the research and try and bring the characters to life, because it always has to be about the story and the characters, really. I'm going to actually be talking about doing historical research at the History Festival in Dublin Castle at the end of September, last weekend in September. And I'm looking forward to that, because the way that you go about drawing together the historical evidence is fascinating. But at some stage, you have to park it, because otherwise you have characters who say thee and thou and my liege, and they're not like real people.
Why do you think nobody spoke up for these women? Clearly they were disadvantaged.
Yes, there was a kind of witch fever, I think, reading around the period that took over. I think it was to do with the Presbyterian Calvinistic outlook, which really believed that Satan walked the earth looking for souls to lead into mischief and that they had to be permanently on guard against them. And you don't get that in the Gaelic tradition at all. There have been relatively few witchcraft trials in Ireland compared with Scotland in particular, because I suppose in the Gaelic tradition, the idea of communing with a fairy world or a spirit world isn't traumatic, and also you can use different little tricks against them yourself, putting out your mayflowers or whatever. But in the Scottish tradition, among the Ulster Scots, there were a number of allegations of witchcraft. What I also saw, though, and what fascinated me, was it was women who didn't fit the template. The template was that a woman should be chaste, should be pious, should be fertile, should be silent. And these eight women didn't really fit that template. And while it was a woman pointing the finger, then men stepped in. It was a constable. Well, first of all, it was the ministers who got involved and decided if there was a case to answer, if they'd proceed with it. They were all men, and that crossed the denominations. It wasn't just the Presbyterian ministers. It was the there's no Catholic bashing here, actually. The Catholic Church wasn't involved. It was all the Protestant religions. And then the constable got involved. Then the mayor got involved. The two judges and 12 good men and
how,
true.
How did life end up? How did it finish up for Mary Dunbar?
In real life or in my imagination?
Oh, no, we'll save save your imagination, you know, for what? The book. Let people read the book. In real life, what happened?
That's enough of the imagination. You know what? People drop out of history. We don't really know what happened. After the trial, she seems to have gone home, and I think she got carried away with the attention. And indeed, I think that's why the whole thing got out of hand. There's an idea of an unstoppable horse, that she couldn't put a stop to it, and more names were being mentioned. But she did go home, and then she started talking about three more witches who were attacking her.
And at that stage,
at that stage, you get the idea of someone being shut down, and I suspect she was married off, and that was an end to it.
Okay,
but what happened to the eight women is what bothers me more. I mean, they were imprisoned again. They drop out of history, but their relatives, their descendants, still live in the area, and I suspect that they were marginalised. That life was fairly hard for them. They probably died in poverty.
Right, Martina. Thank you very much indeed for coming to studio. The book is called The House Where It Happened by Martina Devlin. It's published by Ward River Press. It's launched this week and it sells for $16.99, and now we'll be moving very far away from Calvinist activities. We're talking about craft beers after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.